Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know whether to be anxious or frightened this morning, since we have a new addition in our bulletins where you can take notes and write down questions. So I'm grateful that it's there so far. Today, I'd like to address a subject that I think we don't think about much, and that I think we need to think about it more, and hopefully that in thinking about the subject of labor and the meaning of labor in our culture and our democracy, that we can find our own place in time and history, and it will help us become more active citizens or better citizens. I think we're also wrestling with the question, as history moves, are we active in history? Can we make history? Or are we passive and history just moves with us and we really have no control and we just let it happen? I think we also wrestle with that question. The predestination free will question, I think that's also underlining and involved with a sermon today, which is the state of labor in today's world. I'd like to make two points before moving into more direct conversation about labor. And the first point is this, that our values that we say every week in this church, for those values to be active, for those values to be part of our society, we need to live in a democracy. It is an assumption that we live in a democracy which we can activate these values. That's point one. So if we ever feel our democracy is threatened, not only is democracy threatened, but the very values we speak and attest to and confirm, to confirm, promote, and believe in and try to act out our lives in, that's also threatened. A way of life is threatened. Our way of life as Unitarian Universalists is threatened. The second point is the law. Now that may seem to be an odd thing to bring up when we're talking about labor. But the law is crucial. We, I believe, as citizens in this country and as people, we believe that inherent in the law is a movement toward justice. That justice is a core to our legal system. We have that belief. And that all our laws are based upon that belief. That is one foundation to law that could exist. There are others. There's another law, and law is an important aspect to try to wrap our minds around because our society is actually contained in its laws. The laws hold us and contain us. So it's extremely important the type of legal system, legislative process we have, because whatever the laws are, that will dictate how we behave and how we think and how we act. There's also another foundation to laws, and that is there are laws that are based on perpetuating a particular economic structure. No matter what it is, laws exist to perpetuate an economic structure. Laws could exist to perpetuate a just society. They can be the same. They might not be the same. I think that it's interesting to note when we think about the development and the evolution of law itself, that those of our community that are believers in the goddess, especially Mahat, who is anchored in the Dark Mother, which we had talked about before, that the values and the principles of this goddess were actually turned into legal law for the Egyptian kingdom and also Hammurabi's code of laws. And you can see in these early laws coming out of that tradition, what's important is justice, kindness to one another. Let me just read a few. If I commit murder, there's going to be punishment. There will be justice. If there's rape, there will be a consequence, justice. She also says in here, I have not avenged myself. She's not seeking revenge. I have not caused terror. This is a value of this goddess. I have not caused terror. I have not caused none to feel pain. I will do neither harm nor ill, nor will I cause misery. I have made none to weep. I have not stolen, neither have I taken that which does not belong to me, nor that which belongs to another. I have not defrauded, neither have I added to the weight of balance, nor have I made light of the weight of the scales, which was an economic process. I have not laid waste to the plowed land. Think of, I've not laid, if we over-fertilize and we can't, I have not laid waste to the plowed land, nor have I deprived anybody of what was rightfully theirs. I have not accused any person falsely. I have spoken no lies. So these are the values that come from the goddess that have moved into our law. It even gets to the point, and this is extremely, I think, pertinent for labor, it even gets to the point where the values of the goddess turning into the code of laws moves in the direction of saying, if someone loses an eye, if someone causes someone to lose an eye, they will be compensated. If someone has a limb crushed, they will be compensated. If someone has their foot cut off, they will be compensated. We didn't have labor laws to compensate people for loss of limb, loss of eye, until 1938 in this country. But here it is in laws of 3000 before the Common Era. Where did the laws of justice that were first infused turn into laws that were based on an economic system? An example of this. Speaking of child labor, as we were talking about the children, in 1832, there was a proposal that children should not be allowed to labor in the factories from morning till night, which means they were laboring in the factories from morning till night, without any time for healthy recreation, mental culture that endangers their well-being and health. That was a proposed law. Minimum ages for factory work, it was in 1836. Factories to attend school at least 3 months of year. They wanted children to be able to attend school. Massachusetts wanted the 10-hour workday for children. Okay, and that was in 1876. In 1892, the children started to get some rights. It was not a federal law to limit and work around the minimum age of children and work for child labor until 1938. Over 100 years for our economy, for our culture, for our court system to move a law through to protect children from being abused in factories. I'm suggesting at that point what we have is we have a conflict between laws based on justice and fairness and the welfare of people and laws that support a particular economic structure. And that we live in a culture where those two foundations of our law are in conflict. And that when we talk about labor, we need to understand that if we're operating in a system where the laws are based on an economic structure, and we're trying to say we want labor laws for children, or we want labor laws for safe work environments, and we try to implement those labor laws in a society that's based on laws of an economic structure, it's going to take us 100 years to make a change. Now, during that 100 years, we had the Civil War, we had World War I, and we had the Great Depression. After each war, something interesting happens. There's a consolidation of capital, and there's a consolidation of power of a particular group of people that own the factories, that own the means of production. After every war, that group gets tighter, smaller, and more powerful. What happened in the United States was, as that happened, those people also controlled the legislative process. This is something I want to stress to who we are as citizens in our culture. when we pay attention to politics and we pay attention to not necessarily who's running for office, because sometimes I think we're distracted by who's running for office, we need to be paying attention to what legislation's being passed. We need to be paying attention to who's proposing what legislation. Because if we're not paying attention to the legislation, we're forgetting that we are in the tension of a legal system based on justice and a legal system based on a particular economic structure. And it is the legislative process that will determine which way we lean. We're distracted by personalities. Have we been distracted by personalities in the past 2 weeks? Who does what? When? Now, we're more interested, it seems to me, in the biographies of presidents and the biographies of political people than we are the movement of legislation through time and through history. That's a mistake. As citizens, we need to pay attention to the movement of legislation and how it affects our culture as it moves through time. The personalities come and go, and do and can become very distracting. Something interesting happened in the 1890s. I mean, we had strikes, and I don't know if you're familiar with some of the history about strikes, but if you need to, we have a resource that we use called the back of a t-shirt. We have the strikes and how many got killed and what was going on with those strikes. But what I noticed in reading about strikes is the National Guard and the federal government never came in on the side of strikers. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but everything I've read, and I'm thinking the National Guard, the police, the people who work, they're supposed to serve them. But how is it? Not once did the federal government come in for strikers. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. And brutally so. Brutally so. How many of you saw what happened to protesters at the two conventions? Both. It was brutal. Brutal. These are people that are paid to protect citizens. What I want to say is that's been going on since the beginning of our nation. That's not new. And when I say that we need to live in a democracy to actualize our values, what we're witnessing is not democracy. So when we talk about labor, we're talking about the elevation of people so that they can have a dignified life, so that they can participate in the discourse of what's going on in our lives, what's going on in their own lives. But that apparently, for the workers to gain a sense of dignity, for the workers to gain a sense of pride, a sense of empowerment, that they have the right to participate in the legislative process, in the dialogue, in the discourse in our country to shape our culture, that's a threat to somebody. Let me read something from a story about in 1896. And again, this is National Guard being set up to oppose strikes, and a bit about the life of workers. As new rifles and equipment were being issued to the National Guard in 1901, the miners, too, began arming themselves, but with more than guns. The Cripple Creek miners had 8,000 volumes in their library, housed in a new union building. This fact was typical. The Western Federation of Miners had increased from 12,000 members in 1896 to 25,000 members in 1901. All over the Rocky Mountains, they were building new union halls, conducting classes, holding debates, Lectures on everything from the possibility of a nationwide industrial union to drama and English literature. It was this sudden predilection for thinking. It was this movement toward thinking on the part of the men and women who felt as if they were capable as any Americans living in this culture. This is what frightened the mine owners more than the miners' determination to defend their homes and jobs. Thinking. At that same time, there's a story about a person who owned discount stores. This is around in 1910. And there was a movement that said that we need to have the workers' minds occupied with the things that we make. Because if we allow them to be on their own, they become radicals. They become a problem. They think. And it was in the early 1900s, it was an intentional decision to occupy our mind and time with consumerism. Not to think. When you have wars, something else happens. Productions of goods are contained within the nations that are at war. So production is centralized. When production becomes centralized, workers are centralized. They're grouped together. When they're grouped together, they have more power. Because production was centralized, strikes became more effective. When strikes become more effective, then the workers have a greater bargaining process. So much so that in the 1970s, and I've said this before, that in order to understand our history as a country, we need to look at the triangle and the lens of citizens, workers, businesses, and government. And we need to be able to stand and look at the eyes from each point of that triangle to understand and interpret what's happening. So I need to be able to look out from the eyes of the worker, I need to be able to look out from the eyes of business, and I need to be able to look out from the eyes of government to really understand what's happening in our culture. In the 1970s, there seemed to be almost an equal balance that the citizens, the labor movement, brought citizenship to the point where they could introduce legislation to say to businesses, we don't want you polluting our environment any longer. The Environmental Protection Agency, Richard Nixon, put into law, that gave the government the right. The government had no right to say that before then. Remember the Cleveland River that was catching on fire? I mean, there were some horrible things. And when we first decided as a nation to find out what pure water was, so we had a measuring stick to measure water, no place in our country could we find water that did not have contaminants. Is that right? Right. We could not find any place. So by the time we started becoming aware that we were contaminating our environment, there wasn't a place that was pure. So they got the best water they could. So the people said, enough. Enough. OSHA, occupational safety, people could come on and say, this is a problem. You have to fix that up. It's not safe. You have to do that. So it's just not unions against company. See, it's just not the people that worked in the factories, the people that worked in the fields that said this was unsafe and going up against that. The government was now coming in and saying, you need to provide a safe environment. The triangle shifted. The citizens became more involved politically. Who remembers 1968 around the world, the people stood up and spoke and rippled through the whole world that the people were standing up and speaking. So in the 70s, our government is actually passing legislations to bring better balance between citizens, business, and government. It was not oppressive, a better balance. We actually had a voice in the governing process. That became a problem. Whereas for me, that's a celebration of the effort of a 170-year struggle. There was some parity, some listening. So in the early 1970s, the businesses that did not like, and this is certainly not all businesses, but the businesses that did not like these regulations began to protest. This is the beginning of shifting our legislation to pay for factories to move out of this country into other countries. This is the beginning of that. When the people's voices rose up, we see the beginning of something shifting in our culture. David Rockefeller began the Trilateral Commission. In 1991, he had this to say about his response to what's happened in the 70s and that parody of that triangle. Quote, at the Trilateral Commission meeting in 1991, David Rockefeller. We are grateful to the Washington Post, to the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected the promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But, and this is quote, but the world is more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government. Now, when I first hear that, you know, we think science fiction, we think all kinds of stuff, but the president, Bush, said one world government. I mean, that's a quote. Now, here's where it gets frightening for me as a person who believes in a value system that needs a democracy in order to foster a culture of liberty and freedom. See, the supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national self-determination practiced in past centuries. I don't remember being in that discussion. I just don't. So this is bigger than any particular corporation. It's bigger than that. It's bigger than somebody spending their energy to trying to figure out whether we're conservative or whether we're liberal. Because whether we're conservative or liberal, my hunch is we believe in democracy. Wherever we fall, we believe in democracy. We believe in the participation of the citizenship to have self-determination of their culture, society, and individual self in community. These are our core beliefs. That quote indicates that's not every citizen's core belief, nor are those conversations happening where we have access to hear them. What has happened since then? The centralization of production, which was the centralization of labor that gave people power to say enough, quit polluting, we want better wages, we want a living wage, and I think that is an odd term, a living wage. So it means if I'm not getting paid a living wage, then am I a dead wage? I don't know exactly how to deal with that language of a living wage that we invite companies into our cities and not pay living wages is problematic. What do you do if you're on that page that in that group of the Trilateral Commission, what do you do if you're a person that doesn't want that equal parity and that you know that the unions who were really strong and part of the core process of challenging the abusive leadership that was going on, what do? You don't fight the unions because they're at our most powerful place at that point. You eliminate their place of work. Now we have factories. I can remember my father telling me a story where they won this legislation, and on these huge machines in the steel plant, they finally won the legislation where they had to put safety guards and devices at appropriate places. And he said a week later they were taking those machines apart and shipping them to China. And his question was, do they keep the guards? Do they keep the guards? So we have the decentralization, and this is key when we think about the state of labor today. We have the decentralization of production. Production, there's a part for your car made in Mexico, made in Canada, made in the United States, made in China, made in Europe, made in Africa. There's a part, and nothing is centralized. When it is decentralized, if these people get upset with what's going on and they go on strike, all they have to do is shut the doors because it has no meaning, because they'll just perpetuate and make this piece of the machinery over here. There's no power of a large group because there's no large group. The decentralization of production is key to the state of labor today. It is the state of labor today. There are groups in our world that are meeting that are confronting this. There's an international trilateral commission decentralized production process going on. This group says there needs to be an international response to that. Just like there was a national response, and a national response that increased the labor unions and that gave them power. They had a meeting in 2001 in Brazil, and about, I think, 4,000 people showed up. Now, these were people just like the people in Seattle at the World Trade Organization. Remember that? Or in Miami. Remember that? Or, let's say, Denver and St. Paul, right? The city officials welcomed them. The police welcomed them. They facilitated their process. Not only were they talking about the serious issues, there were festivals, there were dancing, there was singing, there was local artists, there was a celebration of what it meant to be human at that place at that time. And they were all from all over the world. And some of them were a bit upset because there was a noticeable absence of people from the United States of America participating in this process. I never heard of it. And I'm not saying that our media is censored, that we wouldn't hear about those things. But I never heard of it. You know, why not? It was a worldwide event. And they've had them since. Are we, as citizens of the United States of America, at a place in history that if we are going to maintain our democracy, are we at a place where we need to align ourselves with groups outside our country in order to maintain our country? Is that where we are? One thing that has always upset me about the church, we are always 50 years behind addressing societal issues. There was ghettos, there was poverty, and before the church really responded in the social gospel movement in 1870, that had been going on for 100 years. We're always behind. We don't have to be behind today. That international movement's a cutting-edge movement to deal with what they consider to be oppression, and we would have to make that individual decision. You would if you feel that's oppression. and that's a threat to our democracy as a nation. Are the transnational corporate process a threat to our democracy? Not a threat to our being conservative, to being liberal, a threat to our democracy, a threat to the values that we speak every week, that we commit to. If we see this process, this decentralization of production, the disempowering of the citizen's voice as a threat to democracy, then it's a threat to the very notion of what it means to be Unitarian Universalist. Are we called then, if there's some merit to what I'm saying, are we called as Unitarian Universalists to align ourselves to people outside our own country to help save our democracy? And that is for you to struggle with and answer.